Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Howard Zinn talks about America's wars and the mindset that gets us into those wars. I hope you'll stay tuned. We continue with part two of historian Howard Zinn's fine speech of 2008. He spoke in Binghamton, New York, 3 days after the presidential election. In last week's installment, Zinn scolds our government for not even trying to establish real social justice. Social justice as defined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. That would include, among other things, guaranteed health care, fair wages for all workers, adequate housing, and a clean environment. Zinn identifies two major obstacles to social justice in the United States. One, entrenched economic interests, and two, the government's obscenely high spending on the military. In this week's installment, Zinn focuses on the bloated military and the absurd imperialist wars that the United States has been fighting. He speaks of the faulty American mindset, including President-elect Obama's mindset, that supports all these needless wars. Here are some elements Zinn identifies of that mindset. Belief in American exceptionalism. Denial of our imperialism. False patriotism. Faulty definitions of national security and the national interest. And a false definition of heroism. Speaking of, candidate Donald Trump was lambasted by the establishment and all the establishment media for saying that John McCain was no military hero. Trump was denounced by left and right for saying that being captured and imprisoned in war does not in itself constitute heroism. Trump's words lacked tact, but I have always felt that he was entirely correct. Well, 8 years before Trump disputed McCain's heroism, Air Force veteran Howard Zinn did the same. You'll hear that passage today. Zinn's talk is titled, The Power to Change. Here is part two.
No, we have to speak what we believe is the truth. And I think the truth is, we should not be at war. We should not be at war at all. These wars are absurd. They're horrible and they're absurd. From a human point of view, they're horrible. You know, the deaths and the mangled limbs and the blindness and the 3 million people in Iraq losing their homes, having to leave their homes. 3 million people, imagine, having to look elsewhere to live because of our occupation, because of our war for democracy, our war for liberty, our war for whatever it is we're supposed to be fighting for. No, we need a president who will say, yeah, I'm giving advice to Obama. I know he's listening. But, you know, if enough people speak up, he will listen, right? If enough people speak up, he will listen. No, there's much more of a chance of him listening, right, than those other people. They're not listening. They wouldn't listen. Obama could possibly listen if we, all of us, and the thing to say is, we have to change our whole attitude as a nation towards war, militarism, violence. We have to declare that we are not going to engage in aggressive wars. We are going to renounce the Bush doctrine of preventive war. Oh, we have to go to, you know, or we have to go to war on this little pitiful country because this little, pitiful country might someday do what? Attack us? I mean, Iraq might attack us? Well, they're developing a nuclear weapon, one, which they may have in 5 or 10 years. That's what all the experts said, even the experts on the government side. You know, they may develop one nuclear weapon in 5 years. Wow. The United States has 10,000 nuclear weapons. Nobody says, how about us? You see, you know all about that. Weapons of mass destruction, et cetera, et cetera. No. No reason for us to wage aggressive wars. We have to renounce war as an instrument of foreign policy. And really, we save a lot of money. We have to dismantle the military bases we have all over the world. You know, this peace-loving country has troops in 100 different countries in the world. 100 different countries, we have military bases. That doesn't look like a peace-loving country. And besides, I mean, first of all, of course, it's very expensive. We save a lot of money. Do we really need those bases? What do we need those bases for? I can't figure out what we need those bases for, you know. So we have to, we have to give that up. And we have to declare ourselves a peaceful nation. We will no longer be a military superpower. Oh, that's terrible. There are people who think we must be a military superpower. We don't have to be a military superpower. We don't have to be a military power at all, you see. We can be a humanitarian superpower. Yeah. We'll still be powerful, we'll still be rich, but we're going to use that power and that wealth to help people all over the world. I mean, instead of sending helicopters to bomb people, send helicopters when they face a hurricane or an earthquake and they desperately need helicopters, you know. So, yeah, there's a lot of money available once you seriously, fundamentally change the foreign policy of the United States. Now, Obama has been hesitant to do that, and has something to do with a certain mindset, because it doesn't have anything to do really with politics, that is with, more votes. I don't think, do you think most Americans know that we have bases in 100 countries? I'll bet you if you took a poll and asked among the American people, how many countries do you think we have bases in? Now, I don't know exactly what the answer is in, but I would guess, you know, there'd be like 5, 10. But I think most people would be surprised. In other words, there isn't a public demanding that we have bases in 100 countries, so there's no political advantage to that. Well, of course, there's economic advantage to corporations that supply those bases and build those bases and make profit from those bases, you know. And I do believe that the American people would welcome a president who said, we are not going to wage aggressive war anymore. The American people are not war-minded people. They become war-minded when a president gets up there and creates an atmosphere of hysteria and fear and, you know, and says, well, we must go to war. Then people, without thinking about it, without thinking, you know, why are we bombing Afghanistan? Because, Osama bin Laden is there. Where? Well, they don't really know. So we'll bomb the country. You know, if we bomb the country, maybe we'll get them. You see? Sure, in the process, thousands of Afghans will die, right? But so people didn't have time to stop and think. But the American people are not war-minded people. They would welcome, I believe, a turn away from war. So there's no real political advantage to that, but it has to do with a mindset, a certain mindset that, that a lot of Americans have, and that Obama, obviously, and the Democratic leadership, Pelosi and Harry Reid and the others, that they all still have. And when you talk about a mindset that they have, which stands in the way of the declaring against war, you're reminded that during the campaign, I don't know if you remember this, that at one point Obama said, and you know, there were many times in the campaign where he said really good things if he'd only followed up on them, you see, and if he only follows up on them now. But at one point in the campaign, he said, it's not just a matter of getting out of Iraq. It's a matter of changing the mindset that got us into Iraq, you see. That was a very important statement. Unfortunately, he has not followed through by changing his mindset, you see. He knows somewhere in, well, and he expressed it, that we have to change our mindset, but he hasn't done it. Why? I don't know. It's because there are too many people around him and too many forces around him, and et cetera, that, but no, that mindset is still there. So I want to talk about what that mindset is, what the elements of that mindset are. I have to look at my watch. Not that it matters. Not that I care. But, you know, I feel conscience-stricken over keeping you here just to hear the truth. And here are some of the elements of the mindset that stand in the way for Obama, in the way for the Democratic Party, in the way for many Americans, in the way for us. And one of the elements in a mindset is the idea, somehow, that the United States is exceptional. In the world of the social science, and you know that discipline called social science, there's actually a phrase for it. It's called American exceptionalism. And what it means is the idea that the United States is unique in the world, you know, that we are different, that we, not just different, we're better, right? We are better than other people. We're, you know, our society is better than other society. This is a very dangerous thing to think. When you become so arrogant that you think you are better and different than other countries in the world, then that gives you a carte blanche to do nasty things. You can do nasty things because you're better. You're justified in doing those things because we're different. What's that? Right on. I haven't heard that phrase since 1968. but it shows that progress is not lost. So we have to divest ourselves of the idea that, you know, we are somehow better, and, you know, we are the city on the hill, which is what the first governor of Massachusetts, Tom Winthrop, said. We are the... Reagan also said that. Well, Reagan said lots of things, you know. We are, you know, we're, you know, everybody looks to... No, we're an empire, like other empires. There was the British Empire, and there was the Russian Empire, there was the German Empire, and the Japanese Empire, and the French and the Belgian Empire, the Dutch Empire and the Spanish Empire, and now there's the American Empire. And our empire. And when we look at those empires, we say, oh, imperialism. But our empire, no. Yeah, there was one sort of scholar who wrote in the New York Times, he said, we are an empire light. Light? Tell that to the people of Iraq. Tell that to the people in Afghanistan. Now, you know, we are an empire light. No, we are heavy. All you have to do is look at our history, and you'll see, no, our history does not show a beneficent country doing good all over the world. Our history shows expansion. It shows us... it shows us moving into doubling our territory with the Louisiana Purchase, which I remember on our schoolroom maps looked very benign. Oh, there's all that empty land, and now we have it. It wasn't empty. There were people living there. There were Indian tribes. Hundreds of Indian tribes were living there, you see. And if it's going to be ours, we've got to get rid of them. And we did. We instigate a war with Mexico in 1848, and at the end of the war, we take almost half of Mexico, you know. And why? We wanted that land. That's very simple. We want things. There's a drive of nations that have the power and the capacity to bully other nations, tendency to expand into the areas that those other nations have. We see it all over the world. And the United States has done that again and again. And, you know, and then we expanded into the Caribbean, and then we expanded out into the Pacific with Hawaii and the Philippines. And of course, you know, in the 20th century, expanding our influence in Europe, in Asia, and now in the Middle East, everywhere. An expansionist country, an imperialist power. For what? To do good things for these other people? Or is it because we coveted? When I say we, I don't mean to include you and me. But I've gotten, you know, they've gotten us so used to identifying with the government. You know, like I say, we, like the janitor at General Motors says, we. No. No, the CEO of General Motors and the janitor are not we. No, we're not. Exceptionalism is one part of the mindset we have to get rid of. We have to see ourselves honestly for what we are. We're an empire like other empires. We're as aggressive and brutal and violent as the Belgians were in the Congo, as the British were in India, and all these other empires. Yeah, we're just like them. We have to face it. When you face that, you sober up a little, and then you don't think you can just go all over the world and say, oh, we're doing this for liberty and democracy. And because then if you know your history, you know how many times that was said. Oh, we're going into the Philippines to bring civilization and Christianity to the Filipinos. We're going to bring civilization to the Mexicans, et cetera, et cetera. No. You'll understand that. That's one element in this mindset. And that, of course, when you say these things, when you go back into the history, when you try to give an honest recounting of what we have been, not we really, what the government has done, our government has done. People haven't done it. People, we're just people. The government does these things, and then they try to include us and involve us in their criminal conspiracy. You know, we didn't do this, but they're dragooning us into this. But when you start criticizing, when you start making an honest assessment of what we have done in the world, they say you're being unpatriotic. Well, you have to. That's another part of the mindset you have to get rid of. Because if you don't, then you think you have to wear a flag in your lapel, or you think you have to always have American flags around you, and you have to show by your love for all this meaningless paraphernalia that you are patriotic. Well, that's, you know, an honest presidential candidate would not be afraid to say, you know, patriotism is not a matter of wearing a flag in your lapel, not a matter of this or matter. Patriotism is not supporting the government. Patriotism is supporting the principles that the government is supposed to stand for. You know. Yeah, so we need to redefine these things which have been thrown at us and which we've imbibed without thinking, not thinking, oh, what really is patriotism? If we start really thinking about what it is, then we will reject those cries that you're not patriotic, and we'll say, patriotism is not supporting the government. When the government does bad things, the most patriotic thing you can do is to criticize the government, because that's the Declaration of Independence. That's our basic democratic charter. The Declaration of Independence says governments are set up by the people to They're artificial creations. They're set up to ensure certain rights, the equal right to life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. So when governments become destructive of those ends, the Declaration said, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish the government. That's our basic democratic charter. People have forgotten what it is. It's okay to alter or abolish the government when the government violates its trust. And then you are being patriotic. And when the government violates its trust, the government is being unpatriotic. So, yeah. So we have to think about these, you know, these words and phrases that are thrown at us without giving us a time to think. And, you know, we have to redefine these words like national security. What is national security? Well, you say, well, this is for national security. Oh, that takes care of it. No, it doesn't take care of it. National security means different things to different people. There's some people, and some people, national security means having military bases all over the world. For other people, national security means having health care, having jobs. You know, that's security. So, yeah, we need to sort of redefine these things. You know, we need to redefine terrorism. Otherwise, the government can throw these words at us. Oh, we're fighting against terrorism. Oh, well, then I guess we have to do this. Wait a while. What do you mean by terrorism? Well, we sort of have an idea what terrorism means. Terrorism means that you kill innocent people for some belief that you have. Yeah, blowing up at 9/11, yeah, that was terrorist. But if that's the definition of terrorism, killing innocent people for some belief that you have, then war is terrorism. You see. So we have to change our mindset. We have to stop thinking that solutions to problems are military solutions, that you can solve problems with violence. You can't really, don't really solve problems with violence. We have to change our definitions of heroism. Heroism in American culture so far, really, when people think of heroism, they think of military heroes. They think of the people whose statues are all over the country, you know. And they think of medals and battles. And, yeah, these are military heroes. And that's why Obama goes along with that definition of hero by referring to John McCain, you know, as a military hero, always feeling that he must do that. I never felt he must do that. John McCain, to my mind, and I know this is a tough thing to accept and may make some people angry, John McCain was tortured and bore up under torture and was a victim of torture and imprisonment and, takes fortitude to do that. He's not a military hero. Before he was imprisoned, he dropped bombs on innocent people. He did what the other members of the Air Force did. They dropped bombs on peasant villages and killed a lot of innocent people. I don't consider that heroism. So we have to redefine. To me, the great heroes are the people who have spoken out against war. Those are the heroes, you know. Yeah, I think we have to change our mindset. We have to understand certain things that we haven't maybe thought about. I think one of the things we haven't thought about enough, because this is basic and this is crucial, we haven't realized, or at least not expressed it consciously, that the government's interests are not the same as our interests, really. And so when they talk about the national interest, they're creating what Kurt Vonnegut used to call a grand falloon. A grand falloon was a meaningless abstraction in which you put things together that don't belong together. You see, a national security, national interest. No, there's no one national interest. There's the interest of the president of the United States, and then the interest of the young person he sends to war. They're different interests, you see. No, There's the interest of Exxon and Halliburton, and there's the interest of the worker, the nurse's aide, the teacher, the factory worker. Those are different interests. Once you recognize that you and the government have different interests, that's a very important step forward in your thinking, because if you think you have a common interest with the government, well, then it means that if the government says you must do this and you must do that, and it's a good idea to go to war here, well, the government is looking out for my interest. No, the government is not looking out for your interest. The government has its own interests, and they're not the interests of the people. Not just true in the United States, it's true everywhere in the world. Governments generally do not represent the interests of their people. See? That's why governments keep getting overthrown. Because people at a certain point realize, hey, no, the government is not serving my interest. That's also why governments lie. Why do governments lie? And you must know that governments lie. Not just our government, governments in general lie. Why do they lie? They have to lie. Because their interests are different than the interests of ordinary people. If they told the truth, they would be out of office. So, have to recognize, that the difference in interest.
Here again, we must pause Howard Zinn's fine address of 2008, The Power to Change. You'll recall that change was one of Barack Obama's campaign slogans. Zinn saw right off that what Obama was proposing to do was no real change, but rather more of the same, including war, war, and more war. For the original recording of Zinn, our thanks to Lynn Gary and the Unwelcome Guests Collective. I have snipped out some pauses and stumbles in the original talk. As always, thank you for listening to New World Notes. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, reminding you that they are few and we are many, advising that war is not healthy for children and other living things, and hoping you'll tune in again for the remainder of Zinn's talk next week. Till then.